Let's do it.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Health Committee. It is April 8th, and only three more meetings to go to get all of our Senate bills out after today. With that, I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 773. Public hearing first, and then so.
Senate Bill 773 directs coordinated care organizations to continue to provide health services to children in foster homes or residential facilities who move out of geographical areas served by the CCO until the child enrolls in the new residence. It establishes that CCOs must enroll children who move into the geographical area no later than 30 days after the child establishes residence. There is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact and no amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I came to offer testimony on where this bill came from. It is a bill that comes from your Human Services Committee. This came out of a conversation at the Alliance of Children's Programs in January. I just got the name wrong. But the issue was that kids, when moving, who are in foster care or residential care, their availability of safe and appropriate care providers and settings knows no geographic or political boundary. And when they move from one geographical boundary that's served by one CCO to another geographical boundary that may be served by another CCO, their need for medications and support does not end. So people were telling stories of a child that went without an inhaler, a child that went without mental health medications, a child that went without diabetic medications, because there was an argument someplace else about who was responsible for making that payment. The intention of this bill is simply to make clear that these vulnerable children need to have access to their medications and their medical services, and whatever happens behind the curtain in terms of where the kid is enrolled needs to happen without disrupting care of kids. It's simply not acceptable for a child to go without their inhaler, without their diabetes medications, and certainly without their mental health meds. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Well, you know, you're the only one that signed up, and not one CCO has signed up to testify in this bill. And I don't know if there are any CCOs that want to testify on this. It has to do with out of network. And I would like to at least have you come forward, not now, but we will give you the opportunity to think about it, but because I need to get through work sessions first. All right? All right. All right.
Am I set?
Yes, you're
all
set.
Right.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
I'm not going to close the public hearing. We'll keep it open, but we're going to have to come back to that.
Which one do I need to go to?
Okay. Dr. Bates is here for Senate Bill 841, so I'm going to just open a public hearing on Senate Bill 841 to just allow him to speak also, and then we're going to go to public hearing. Sina.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 841 requires health benefit plans to reimburse for prescription drugs in accordance with the plan synchronization policy. It specifies that the plan must prorate cost-sharing requirements applied to dispensing less than a 30-day supply for purposes of synchronization. It requires the plan to fully reimburse partially or filled or refilled prescriptions. There is no amendment, no revenue impact, and fiscal statements have not been issued.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and fellow committee members. I want to start by saying I'm Senator Alan Bates from District 3. To my right is a young lady who we met about 30 years ago and found out that we were cousins, he from California, me from Detroit. She can explain that to you later. It's an ugly story for her. That said, I also did a survey this morning on senators and representatives. It appears the entire Senate, for the most part, almost all the legislators in the building were awake last night at 2 a.m. for no apparent reason. I think it has something to do with bills dying. I'm not sure, but most of us are up. So this is the synchronization bill, Senate Bill 841. This is actually an outcome from a bill we passed last year, Senate Bill 1579. What we're trying to do with this bill is really pretty straightforward. I'm going to try to explain it from the point of view of a physician with patients. I commonly have people come to my office who are on four or five different drugs. Some of them are, quite frankly, life-saving. They come into me. Their blood pressure is out of whack, or their cholesterol is not where it should be, or their glycohemoglobin A1C is not where it's supposed to be. I have to figure out what's going on. And what usually is going on is they didn't take their medication. They didn't take their medication because they ran out. They ran out, and they've been to the pharmacy three times that month, got everything but their fourth pill, and said, you know, I just want to go back again. It probably doesn't matter that much, so I just won't take the medication. What it ends up doing is not only get them in trouble with their doctor, because I'm very upset with them for not doing that, of course, but more importantly, some of these people end up in the emergency room with issues or end up in hospitalization because they haven't taken their medication because they had too much trouble getting it. The bill last year, was designed to allow pharmacists to synchronize these medications. So if you had prescription that was 30 days and ready to go on the 15th, another one on the 17th, another one on the 22nd, they could put those all together in one place and give you all your prescriptions at one time, ensuring you took them all. Now, that sounds pretty simple to do, but there's always a wrinkle. We set it up in a way that we would allow insurers to come up with design plans to do this. There are some issues involved. There's some very expensive drugs that's not appropriate to possibly synchronize with. If the pill is costing you $1,000 a pill and you only get three of them, you have to be careful with these things. You may only want to write it for a week or 2 weeks, but those are rare. The vast majority of what you're writing can be written for a long period of time, actually 90 days, but we want those all synchronized and put together in one place. What we didn't count on was this. There are co-pays involved in these, and there's a dispensing fee for the pharmacist. And some of the insurers decided that they're going to set it up so that if you're getting three pills, you pay your full month copay, and the pharmacist only gets part of their dispensing fee. As a result, patients resist doing this. What this bill does is talk about prorating copays and giving a full amount to the pharmacist for dispensing the prescription. Because the cost to the pharmacist of prescriptions being dispensed, whether it's three pills or 30 pills or 90 pills or 200 pills, is the same. They have to do a certain amount of work to put that prescription out. So this bill actually takes care of that issue. We think it's an important issue. It's what we tried to do last time. This aligns things in a way that what we were intending to have happen will start happening. This doesn't take place until January 1st of 2016, so people have time to get their systems ready to adjust for proration. We understand that many of these companies already have to do it because Medicare requires it, so they have to do it anyway. So they should be able to bring those systems online to get it done, and they've got time until January to get it done. I think it's a reasonable thing to do. The last thing I'd mention also is that Kaiser needs to be cut out of this. Kaiser is an enclosed system. They have their own pharmacies. They have their own prescriptions. They have their own hospitals. They are already doing this because they see this as a long-term way to save money and actually we have better outcomes for their patients. So we're going to offer an amendment before next week, before the work session, that will have that in it. Or we can wait for it to go to the side, whatever you prefer.
It won't be scheduled until next – the work session will be scheduled next week. And so we might, or even the last day on the 20th, right? Our last day is the 20th, on the 20th. So
we should have that ready for you if you wish to hear it.
Okay. And it would be nice if you could just give the language to Zena. I'd like the amendment to just go through her, so to exempt.
Are you sure? The way it's written, I'm not sure they're included, but...
We are looking at that, Madam Chair, Senator Cruz. You may well be right. We're reviewing that right now with LC. LC thinks they may not be included, and no amendment may be necessary. Okay. Thank you for bringing that up.
And then you wanted to also testify on 696.
I will do that first. Good luck. But let my cousin go first, because otherwise I'm going to be in big trouble with
her. Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair and the rest of the committee, thank you very much for hearing the testimony from my family. This is my husband's story.
Your name, please.
Oh, Linda Truax. I live in Ashland.
Thank you.
This is my husband's story. He was not able to be here. My husband has six prescribed medications. They were prescribed over a number of years, and each was called into our pharmacy in Ashland by the prescribing medical doctor. As a result of medical appointments and prescribing of medications on different days and weeks in the month, the 30-day allotment of refills by the pharmacy occurred on different days of the month. which necessitated one close watch of remaining pills in each prescription, multiple calls per month to the pharmacy to request refills, multiple trips to the pharmacy per month to pick up the refills. My husband was able to align or synchronize the refill dates over many months, and as my husband says, it actually took many years before this idea occurred to him by using the following ploy. He did ask the pharmacist if he could get his medications all refilled at the same time, but our insurance company would not allow it. Our health plan allows refills to be requested approximately 6 days prior to running out. By means of hoarding the leftover pills from refilling early, my husband was eventually able to accrue enough of each prescription to eventually be able to request refills for all of my prescriptions on the same day each month. And I really did wonder what he was doing in the kitchen counting all those little pills. When he asked the pharmacist if he could check with our health plan to see if his medications could be aligned, the answer was a simple no. There was no way that they would work with us. And as Dr. Senator Bates says, these are chronic medications that he takes for hypertension, hyperlipidemia, for his thyroid, and so he really is very adherent about not missing his medication. So it took him, I think, 5 months to synchronize his medicines.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I would be glad to, these bills are kind of complex, and I'd be glad to come back for the other bill when the other proponents are here to talk about it later this afternoon. I'll come back in for you.
Okay.
Instead of trying to jump around. Okay?
All right.
Thank you.
All right, we'll still keep 841 open, but now I think we're going to jump to we have some people that are far away, so I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 901. Zena.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 901 requires providers the bill insurers for covered hospital, nursing, medical, or surgical services be reimbursed by direct payment to the provider. There's a -1 amendment which applies the date of January 1st, 2017. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Okay, Evelyn Cole, Shannon Bunyard, and Patty O'Sullivan.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Patricia O'Sullivan. I represent the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and I have two witnesses here that will talk as soon as I explain the bill. What has happened is over the years, there's been some attempts to fix this problem. The problem is this. There are some insurance companies that have, if they do not have a contract with a provider, they will send the payment for reimbursement for services directly to the patient. And so let's say the patient had surgery on their knee or their arm or something. I don't know why they think they can spend the money, but evidently they believe that somebody gives them this money to go to Hawaii to recuperate. And that's frequently what they do. So hospitals, ASCs, and I recently found out yesterday that actually counties are losing money this way. I had the Linn County mental health director contact me and want to talk to me about this. So I had no idea about that. There was a bill last session that you passed that called for two signatures to be on every check. So conceivably, they would send it to the patient. The patient would sign it and then bring it to their doctor or hospital, then they would sign it, then they would keep it. But the problem was people signed it, put it in the bank, and the bank didn't look. They didn't kick it back because there was a second signature line on it. So that didn't really do any good. And the ambulances had found that out years ago and got this changed in their statute. So we're here today with Senate Bill 901, which we're calling the direct pay bill, which requires insurers to directly pay providers for the services rendered and not send checks directly to the patients. I have a short story I wanted to tell you, because I know I'm sitting here representing hospitals and you're thinking, you know, hospitals, whatever. But it affects a lot of people. There was a student down in, went to University of Oregon from out of state. Her family lived on the East Coast. She was over 21 but under 26, so she was insured by her family policy. Did something, I think, to her knee, blew it out, had to have surgery. And the check was sent to her parents' house, and her father spent the money and would not send her any money. And it ruined this girl's credit. She begged her dad to send her the money and not ruin her credit, and he just spent the money. So it's her credit because she's over 21. So it ruined her credit. So it does affect, you know, the folks that actually had the surgery as well. Insurers are neutral on the bill. There's no opposition to this bill. OMA gave me permission to say that they are supportive of this bill. And there are some amendments I want to explain. The amendment today is just changing, it's the dash one, and it's just changing a date in the bill, and we're supportive of that. There's also some dash twos, and there's going to be some threes. And dash twos are Scott Berry's from Aflac, and they have a payment that is a supplement payment. It doesn't go to pay services, and somehow it always gets wrapped in these bills. So this is just to make it clear that they're not an insurer that we're talking about. And then there's also third-party administrators that were left out. That language was left out. We're going to put in and change mental health to behavioral health. Those other amendments, besides 1-1, will be done on the House side. So
even though we have the dash twos, do we have the FSRAs on the dash twos? No.
Okay. Yeah. And I haven't really had a chance to look at them. Mm-hmm. So with that, I'll take any questions, and I will hand it over to Shannon. Thank you.
So my name is Shannon Bunyard, and I am with Adventist Medical Center in Portland, Oregon. I'm also a past board member of the Oregon Healthcare Financial Management Association. So what happened in my testimony, what happened in about 2013, we started getting a lot of calls and placing a lot of calls to patients whose accounts were headed to collections because they hadn't paid their bill. Come to find out, yes, they're insured, but their insurance company had sent their check directly to them. As Patty has stated, they would say to us, we thought that was our money to spend. I don't have it anymore. So unfortunately, a lot of these patients wound up going to collections where their bill still sits, you know, hopefully that they'll make some payment on it. But the most troubling scenario for our facility was a case of a patient who had severe illness, was requiring multiple hospitalization episodes. The illness finally overtook the patient and he passed away. An insurance company had sent multiple checks for these different inpatient episodes, made payable to the patient, to the patient's home. Since he was deceased, he had no way of signing the checks, and we had no way of receiving payment on those. He couldn't pay it because he was deceased. Since we weren't receiving the payments, obviously we were sending those statements to his family because they were being sent to his home address. Very grievous for the family, as you can imagine, to continue getting these statements. The family also had a family friend who was an attorney, so they brought these checks to the attorney. There was no estate. There was no power of attorney. The attorney started sending letters to this insurance company and said, I've got these checks. We can't negotiate them. The hospital can't negotiate them. I called the insurance company multiple times, and after several months, the account has gone to collections. The family is, you know, very concerned. I was able to get the payer to send that payment to us. What I have experienced over the last couple of years is it's a real disservice, not only to the hospitals, but to the patients, because it's having a negative impact on their credit and on their life. They are not wanting to get these checks made payable to themselves. They would prefer it just be paid direct to the hospital. Be easier for them.
Thank you.
Are there any questions?
Let's finish the panel.
Okay.
My name is Evelyn Cole. For the past 7 years, I've been the CEO for Spine Surgery Center of Eugene. We feel like ASCs are great for the healthcare system because they reduce fees for patients and for insurers. ASCs also allow a surgeon to choose what he sees or she sees as the best treatment plan and the best equipment for their patients. Patients pay less because ASCs charge roughly a third less than a hospital does for a surgery, and that reduces the patient's copay. But in spite of that, we see that insurances sometimes deny a contract to an ASC facility, which means that puts the ASC as an out-of-network provider. Our ASC always matches the benefits as though we had a contract so that we keep the fees low, but in the past year or so, insurances have refused to talk to us. So they will send our check. We send the bill. They send our check to the patients, but then they won't tell us that they sent a check, if they're going to send a check, how much the check will be, or if it was cashed. That used to be the case. They used to be able to tell us, but now they've decided that their contracts are with the patient and not with us, the provider, and so they refuse all information to us. Patients are very confused about these checks. Sometimes they get multiple checks. They think they're being reimbursed for out-of-pocket medical expenses. They may send the wrong check to the wrong provider and then have a hard time figuring it out when they get the second check. They may even deny to us that they've received a check, and we have no way of verifying if they did get the check or they did not get the check because we, again, cannot communicate with the insurance company. The insurance companies tell us that their contract is not with us, so they don't have a responsibility to talk to us. I have a couple of scenarios I'd like to tell you about, examples of patients that have been in our center recently where this has impacted them. Patient number one was an older gentleman, received three checks. First check came, he signed it over to, as you know, with surgeries, there are multiple providers. There's a surgeon, there's a radiologist, there's an anesthesiologist, and so forth. So he gets these checks. He doesn't know which provider they're supposed to go to. So he sends the checks where he thinks they should go, but then finds out it's all wrong. He comes to us and says, please help me figure this out. Insurance won't talk to us, so we can't help him with that scenario. The second one patient was a patient who was going through a difficult divorce when she had a fusion. Our surgery center billed $41,000 for the fusion. The ex-husband now got the checks, $20,000 in checks. She's in a homeless shelter, but he kept the checks anyway. And when we tried to communicate with him, he refused to talk to us. Eventually, the divorce decree declared that the surgery was his responsibility to pay. He calls us, and he says, well, my insurance plan says I have $8,000 maximum out-of-pocket benefit. Why do I have to pay you more than $8,000? So we tried to explain to him it's because the insurance sent you our checks, and you kept those checks. He's now on a payment plan of $250 a month, and it's going to take him approximately 10 years to pay for this surgery. So it's impacting everybody. All of these would be satisfied if the Senate bill would pass so that those checks would come to the providers and not be such a burden on the patient as well as the ASC.
All right. Thank you very much. There's no one else to testify. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill
901
and open a work session on Senate Bill 901. I do believe we have all the paperwork.
Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 901.
Senator Cruz moves dash one amendments into Senate Bill 901. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Adopted.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 901 as amended by the dash one amendment to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 901 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
I just wanted to put some comments on the record.
Is there any discussion?
Yes,
Senator
thank you.
Shields.
I just want to make sure she saw that. I just wanted to declare a potential conflict of interest. My wife's a nurse practitioner that may be affected by this bill.
Thank you. Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair, I'm doing this with the absolute assurance from Patty O that the amendments will happen on the House side. So,
yes. Okay. And I've talked with her also, okay. And so that will happen. With that, clerk will call the roll.
Senator
Knope?
Aye.
Senator
Shields?
Aye.
Senator Harris?
Aye.
Senator Cruz?
Aye.
General
Kennedy? Aye. Motion carries. I'll carry the bill. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 9.
Work session.
A work session on on Senate Bill 901, and where do we go from here? Okay, right from the top.
121, you can wait. She's not on Aaron. If you want Aaron to explain that, she's not on Aaron.
Okay. All right, let's open a work session on 186. This is the EPI bill, and there are still some concerns. So, Zena, will you bring us up to date?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 186 allows entities to require pre-measured doses of epinephrine and necessary paraphernalia from the Oregon Health Authority if it is identified as presenting a risk of harm to those with severe allergic responses to insects, stings, and other allergens. It allows a healthcare professional to transfer the epinephrine and paraphernalia to an approved entity. It establishes that training on allergic responses be conducted by a healthcare professional supervised by a physician or nurse practitioner. And specifies that no cause of action shall arise against the person who administers the doses in good faith while pursuing emergency treatment. There's a -3 amendment which allows an entity which acquires epinephrine and necessary paraphernalia to make it available to any person under specified circumstances. It adds that paraphernalia be kept locked and permits remotely unlocking. It requires the communication device to be attached to the container and specifies the consulting practitioner must have prescription privileges and administration to the individual that the person believes is in good faith is suffering a severe allergic response. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Okay. As you know, Katie King had brought forward some concerns that the docs, the ER, are... Katie, would you get up here real quick?
She's always been a problem, you know. It just
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Katie King, and I'm here today representing the Oregon chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians. And on this particular bill, there's been discussion about it within the board. They also met on Monday, and there was a robust discussion about the bill. And they have some information that may be helpful to the discussion on 186. One, I had asked the question, is epinephrine harmful if it's administered by somebody accidentally, or it turns out that they're not really suffering an allergic reaction? And I was told it is not a harmless drug. It's one of the most powerful medications that they administer. It's so powerful that they only use it for life-threatening conditions such as cardiac arrest, septic shock, or anaphylaxis. So that was one of the things. And they said that improper use of epinephrine can and does cause heart attacks, strokes, and other hypertensive emergencies. And in fact, errors with epinephrine are the most common medication error in the pre-hospital setting. So that's even in the hands of trained paramedics. I asked, are these public dispensing machines similar to AEDs, which are also considered life-saving? And I was told AEDs treat cardiac arrest, and cardiac arrest can be determined by a simple electronic algorithm. And they said that's not the case with a possible allergic reaction, and the diagnosis can be difficult to make face-to-face and more so over the phone with an untrained provider. And then I also asked about availability of epinephrine. Is it needed in order to save lives? And the response from the emergency physicians was they weren't clear what the gap in availability was. People in a health crisis should call 911, and epinephrine is currently available to individuals from their doctors with a prescription through the 911 system and also through lay people such as parents or guardians. And so I just wanted to say that while OSEP appreciates the intent behind this, they're not aware of any data that shows that epinephrine is not available, and that includes public health data. I think that there's been one death from anaphylaxis outside the hospital setting in the last 10 years. So that's just some information that they wanted to provide to you for consideration. Thank you for calling me up here.
Okay. Fawn Berry, are you in? And she will speak to the dash threes, and this is her bill, so she will address concerns here.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, thank you for having me here to testify today representing Mylan Inc. In support of the Dash 3 amendments. The Dash 3 amendments, just to address those first, seek to clarify the ability of a physician assistant to prescribe and also train around the epinephrine auto-injectors. They also make clear that an authorized entity that acquires epinephrine can provide it to a trained layperson or keep it in this new type of a machine. The amendments clarify that the new machine must be locked until it's opened by a healthcare provider that is available by this remote access. And the amendment also allows an out-of-state healthcare provider to provide the remote consultation so long as the healthcare provider is licensed in the state where they are. To address the concerns by the Emergency Physicians Association, from our perspective...
You forgot to put your name on the record, Fawn.
Oh. Fawn Berry representing Mylan Inc. Sorry, I thought I did that. We feel like any person who has experienced a life-threatening allergic reaction knows how important EpiPen access is. And these machines are meant to be kind of the next step to allow for people who experience a life-threatening allergic reaction to be able to access an EpiPen. Minutes mean lives when you're having a severe allergic reaction. This isn't meant to replace somebody going to the emergency room, but it is meant to be there when the emergency vehicle may not arrive in time to respond to an anaphylactic shock situation. And so we encourage the committee to adopt the Dash 3 amendments and to move this bill forward.
Thank you. So I'm opening it up for discussion. Senator Steiner-Hayward.
I have to say, Madam Chair, thank you. This is the first time in a long time that I found myself incredibly torn about my position on a proposed bill. On the one hand, I think it is possible to coach somebody through, if you have a trained person on the other end of the phone, identifying the signs of a serious allergic reaction. And additionally, I have a brother who has anaphylactic reactions, and because men are not good about these things, doesn't always have his EpiPen with him. And, you know, so far he's managed to avoid an ultimately serious outcome, but has ended up in the emergency department more times than I can count because people hide peanuts and all sorts of interesting things. So having wider availability of epinephrine and having a trained person on the other end of the line to coach somebody through and a controlled way to deliver it, which is somewhat different than AEDs and how we do that, strikes me as a plausible thing to do. On the other hand, I also hear what OSEP is saying. As a physician, I certainly know how dangerous a drug epinephrine can be, and I appreciate the fact that we don't have serious concerning data that we've had a lot of out-of-hospital deaths associated with this. So I got to be honest, I'm really torn about this one, Madam Chair. I see really strong arguments on both sides of this one.
Chair Mona Sanderson,
I know that's not helpful.
Senator Hayward, I should also say that the device is going to have an iPad attached to it, and it is envisioned that they will be able to show the person who is having the allergic reaction to the provider who is on the other end of that device. And so this is the next wave of healthcare and how they are hoping to save lives by putting these kinds of devices in public places where a person might not otherwise be able to access epinephrine auto injectors.
Can I ask a question about that, Madam Chair?
Yeah.
I'm going to assume she said yes.
Yes.
So then my concern to some extent, a phone line, a landline, you know, you can pretty well count on. An iPad requires an internet connection.
Mm-hmm.
And as we all know, internet connections can be a little bit more variable. Now, if they're in big public places, then the chances are good that there's going to be a reliable internet connection, either from a cell phone provider or wireless Wi-Fi. But can you talk a little bit more about how that's going to be dealt with? Because that certainly is a good idea, but it makes me
worry about the other technologic aspects of it.
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Steiner Hayward. I don't know the specifics around what happens if the internet connection breaks. It's all the whole device will be approved by the FDA, and I know that there will be guidelines about, you know, steps that you take in emergency situation. We don't think that this should replace a person's call to 911 saying that somebody is having an allergic reaction and needs to have the ambulance come. That's not the point of this at all, and I don't think that the average person would think, oh, where is one of those machines so that we can access that. So our hope is that a person would call 911, and then they would also be able to access this machine, assuming that that they know that it's there, and that they would be able to reach this person.
Madam Chair, if I may. Thank you. And this discussion is not meant to be confrontational, Ms. Barry, because I think you're clear about where I stand at the moment. Ms. King reported that there's only been one reported out-of-hospital death for someone from anaphylaxis in a period?
10 years.
10 years. Do the data that you have differ from that? And if not, what problem are we trying to fix?
This is in Oregon.
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Steiner Hayward, I would say that in Oregon, I assume that is the correct number. I do know that there have been other cases of anaphylaxis in other states where someone has died as a result of not being able to get life-saving treatment, but I don't have specific figures around how many people. We do know that the earlier that a person is able to get an epinephrine auto-injector administered, the more likely that they are to not suffer severe consequences.
Completely agree. Yeah.
Okay. So at this point in time, B.J. Kevner wants to speak in favor of the bill, and then we need to move on.
Good afternoon. Excuse me, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is B.J. Kevner, and I'd like to speak as a citizen today. Last summer, I was walking my dog when he found a hornet's nest, and was, as dogs do, interested in it, and was completely covered with wasps and hornets. I thought about his safety and started brushing them off and received a number of stings. About 20 minutes after that, I discovered that I was having an anaphylactic reaction to the stings. I had never had an anaphylactic reaction to bee stings before in my life. As a result of that, some great care in OHSU's emergency room, I now carry an EpiPen in almost, I don't have one with me today in my bag, but there's one in my car, in almost everything I have, including, I make sure
that's
going to
really help us a lot when the wasp nest that's hiding under there, Mr. Kavner, starts to come out.
In my bike bag. So my point is that there are times when individuals who are not facing issues with this growing up, and this becomes more of a awareness that this is a need you have to have, that there are the ability and the need to have these type of medications available in places and in situations where they can help people. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, I'm going to close the work session on 186, and we will take it to caucus, both caucuses. Senator Knope, I know it's your bill, and then our caucus. All right. We carry Senate Bill 186 over to Monday, please. And colleagues, Senator Shields just brought to our attention on the bill that we just passed. Oh, never mind. Okay, sorry, it was another bill. Yeah, okay. All right, with that, I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill. We've moved 469 to Monday, so I want to make sure that Senate Bill 469 is carried over to Monday. And are we ready for this one yet? No. I will open a work session on Senate Bill 698. Zena.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 698 creates a school nursing consultant in the Oregon Health Authority. It establishes a 14-member task force on school nursing and directs the task force to examine funding sources for school nurses and make recommendations. It requires the Department of Education to coordinate with the Oregon Health Authority. There's a -4 amendment which specifies that member appointments should represent education service districts and provide health services. It removes a member representing labor organizations and replaces with one member who represents classified school employees who work with nurses. It requires the governor to examine composition of one appointing members. It requires the task force to examine other healthcare funding sources, including billing of student health insurance. It directs the task force to recommend sustainable funding sources. There is no revenue impact in the fiscal statement has been issued, and there is a subsequent referral to Joint Ways and Means.
Ready?
Yes.
Madam Chair, I move the -4 amendment to Senate Bill 698.
Senator Cruz moves to adopt the -4 amendments into Senate Bill 698. Any discussion? Any opposition? It's adopted.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 698 as amended by the -4 amendment to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 698 to the floor with a due pass recommendation with the -4 amendments and be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Mayor Shields?
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries, and I.
It's on its way.
And it's on its way. I'll close Senate work session on Senate Bill 698 and open a work session on Senate Bill 9. Hun, is that one ready to go?
Maybe we can stand at ease for a moment.
Yes. Okay. Could we stand it? 900.
Wait, you need to.
We got to be in session now. Okay, now we're out of recess, right? Okay, I will open a work session on Senate Bill 900. We have the -1 amendments, is that correct?
Yeah.
Yes, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 900 requires the Oregon Health Authority to post data on its website on price information, including median prices paid to hospitals and hospital outpatient clinics for 50 most common inpatient procedures and 100 most common outpatient procedures. There is a -1 amendment which requires the Oregon Health Authority to use data collected to empower consumers of healthcare to make economically sound and medically appropriate decisions not limited to price and quality, and sets a date to July 1st, 2016, and declares an emergency effective on passage. There is no revenue impact, and a fiscal statement has been issued.
Okay. We got the revenue and the fiscal, and I need a copy of the fiscal
Here it is.
Senator Shields stole it.
And basically, OHA estimates the personal services and related services of supplies for this position to be $238,276, and then one FTE for the 2015-17 biennium, and then $137,575 and half an FTE for the 2017-19. So
Deb, I want that job. That pays well.
So that is what it is, and so it's going to need to go to Ways and Means and Hospital Association. Carriers will need to make sure that you are there to plead your case for Senate Bill 900. All right.
Madam Chair, I move the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 900.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 9—moves to adopt the -1 amendments. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? They're adopted.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 900 as amended by the -1 amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation and request a subsequent referral reluctantly to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 900 as amended with the -1s to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a reluctant request to the President's office for a referral to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Senator Steiner Hayward.
Madam Chair, I really appreciate the intent of the Hospital Association with this bill, and I think anything we can do to improve price transparency, as we've discussed, is a good thing. I remain concerned that averages are not the most useful numbers and that they don't really tell most people what they're going to end up having to pay. And so it's certainly a starting point. It's better than nothing. But I'm not sure it's really going to get us very far down this road. So that's where I'm at. I'm perfectly happy to vote it out of committee, and then we'll see where it goes from there.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator.
I have some concerns about the bill. I think that it doesn't go far enough, and I appreciate you sending it to Ways and Means, but I still think that the preferred bill would be Senate Bill 891, so I'll be a no.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
We can overload the public with data. I mean, my God, you know. Let's be real about this. We're going to give them a snapshot, and for most people, even this might be more information than they want. And you know, we get all these data sets in there, and people get lost in the noise.
I guess I'll throw in my two cents too. We rate an F. As far as hospital transparency charges in the state of Oregon. Of course, all states, I think, except one, are rated an F. And in talking, and actually the hospitals, I think in testimony, or maybe they told me, I don't remember, but they did ask, okay, how can we get to an A? And believe it or not, this bill would get us to an A rating. It is a very small step, but
seriously?
It is a step. Yes.
Yeah.
It, yes. It's and so it is a small step. I agree with the good Senator Steiner Hayward that it averages isn't detailed enough. But this is what we have here, and any other discussion? Okay. Clerk will call the roll.
Aye, but no guarantee that I'll vote yes in full Ways and Means. Just to be clear on the record.
Aye.
Nope.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries, and it is on its way as a request to the president.
A reluctant request.
Reluctant request. At that, I'll close the.
Is that a legal term?
Work session on Senate Bill 900. And okay, and we'll now go back to Senate Bill 841. And it is we already have that open. I would like to call up Linda Truax, Steve Bass, Rocky Dallum.
I think Linda already posted that. I think that's the testify with Bates.
Yeah, he already.
No, but Truax already testified.
I think I'm Tom.
Tiff's already.
Tom. Okay.
Is she already here?
Oh, don't we need to call him because he's old for it?
Oh.
BJ Kavanaugh. Okay, please proceed.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thanks for taking the time today to hear my testimony on Senate Bill 841. My name is Dr. Stephen Bass, and I'm a resident of Tigard and currently work as a pharmacist for Fred Meyer and have for the past 8 years. I'm actually sorry that I'm up here today because I really felt that Senate Bill 1579 should have taken care of this for everyone involved, but due to the lack of specific details, we aren't seeing complete participation in the spirit of the original bill. I've been a licensed pharmacist for 12 years now and have been witness to this issue of adherence, medication safety, and economic issues of the patients that I serve. MedSync is a hugely important piece for our patient population that we serve, and not only increasing adherence, but on the safety piece. Think of the reduction of unnecessary, and in this case, I won't use this term medication because it's not useful. I'll say drugs getting into the hands of folks that don't necessarily need them because we're giving medication to people that might not need that quantity when they only needed maybe a short fill to synchronize their treatment to get them to come in a less often basis. You think of some of our communities that not only my company serves, but just pharmacies in general that are rural settings where going to the pharmacy is not as simple as just a few minutes away. It could be a day trip. It could be their event for the week. Now take that and cause the frustrations and impact their care by causing them to come back multiple times, or the frustrations that that causes, or the economic impact that that causes. And then maybe they're just going to give up. Skip it this month. I'll wait till next month. I'll catch up on it. So from a standpoint from myself, it really is disincentivizing patients and providers to participate. So, for example, I have an example from yesterday in dealing with a patient trying to do this exact thing. Sync up his medication so they can get it today and match it up with everything else, and adjudicated the claim, which is sending it to the insurance company. Lo and behold, it's the same exact copay for his few tablets than it would have been to give him a whole month's supply. So in the option and interest of economics, he said, we'll just fill the whole thing. If I'm going to pay the same copay, then I might as well get all the tablets. So it's disincentivizing him to reduce that number of medications that he's going to keep in his house. Maybe with small children. Maybe this was a grandparent or an elderly person. Now there's more medication around. So safety, again, on that patient standpoint. Economics on that patient standpoint. Oregon law is changing with the Board of Pharmacy starting 2016, January 1st, with the auto refill regulations and going to a MedSync-like program where you're having that connection with your patients, where you're having to call to sync their medications. So if we don't have a program in place before that that incentivizes all of us to do that, and also in the pharmacy industry being reimbursed at the full dispensing fee, because whether you get five tablets together, 30, 60, 90, the efforts, the energy, what you're doing is still the same. You still have a bottle. You still have a label. You still have a pharmacist time. You still have information, education, knowledge, things that are going into that. So to do a partial pay, again, the incentivization to help that patient is not there, nor is the financial support. So again, it's unfortunate that not everyone could work together in the spirit of Senate Bill 1579, but here we are. So I encourage you to approve Senate Bill 841, if not for any other reason, but to do it for the average Oregonian, do it for your parents, your grandparents, our children, people that need these medications that are burdened by a disease, and here we are trying to make their life more challenging when they're already at a disadvantage.
Thank you.
So thank you for your time.
Thank
you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is B.J. Kavnor. I serve as Executive Director of 1 in 4 Chronic Health. We are a chronic health collaborative in Oregon. I'm here today to ask for your support of this bill. Quite simply, it is one of the simplest, most economical things that we can do to ensure medication adherence, that patients have access to the medications that they need and only the medications that they need on a timely, regular basis. There are many conditions which require the correct dosage of a medication to be established through trial and error. And oftentimes, patients will have a few pills here and a few pills there. The ability to have the correct medication available in a 30-day or a 90-day increment, whichever is the desired impact, is critical to adherence. Adherence costs us roughly $290 billion a year through emergency room visits, through medical services which need to be followed up with because people don't have access to the medication. And for people living with chronic health conditions, this is a very real issue. We're talking about people who are polypharmacy here. We're talking about patients that take five or more medications on a regular basis. And anything that we can do to keep people being able to get all of this medication at once is just critical. And again, we're not talking about specialty medications that are going to be dispensed through a specialty pharmacy. We're not talking about medications which have a high abuse potential and are narcotics, which require separate hard copies. We're talking about the everyday medications which people with chronic conditions take day after day, month after month.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Monica Anderson, members of the committee, Rocky Dahlem on behalf of the Oregon Bioscience Association. Oregon's bioscience sector represents almost 800 organizations in the state and over 17,000 employees. And we work with this sector through networking, educational programs, enterprise support, advocacy, and the enhancement of research and collaboration. In doing so, working with these firms, we're committed to both the business, legal, as well as the ethical issues related to the sale and use of medical devices, products, and the development of those products. We believe that Senate Bill 841 provides an excellent mechanism for facilitating patients' use of these products as intended by both the manufacturer and as directed by their physicians. We also believe that Senate Bill 841 will have some effect on decreasing health care costs by promoting the use and the proper use of these medications. So we're proud to partner with the patient groups, pharmacists, physicians, the other panelists, as well as Senator Bates and his work on this bill, and ask that the committee support Senate Bill 841. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Any questions? No. All right. Tom Holt.
For the record, I'm Tom Holt with Cambia Health Solutions. We're here, unfortunately, in opposition to Senate Bill 841, not because we're opposed to synchronization per se. I've heard some very compelling reasons why it's a good idea for people to synchronize their medications. We've allowed it for many years. We had the bill just last February. So that we would bring some uniformity across the market. That bill took effect in January. It is disappointing to hear, if it's the case, if this is current information that we're hearing, that some have not implemented it in time. There is a process available for that. It's called the Department of Consumer and Business Services. The bill we did last February was put into the insurance code, so if anyone, whether it's a pharmacy or a covered member of an insurance plan, finds that their insurer is not allowing them to get their prescriptions synchronized, there's a complaint process, and there's a consumer hotline, and the end result of that would be if a carrier was not allowing this at all, then DCBS has a range of sanctions available, beginning with documentation of a corrective action plan so that the health plan would be compliant. They have unlimited ability to levy fines and take other actions. We were very pleased last year to be able to collaborate with good colleagues from the pharmaceutical industry who brought this issue forward and get to a bill that everyone could agree on. The issue we have with this bill is the copay piece. There are a variety of benefit designs in the marketplace. There are some that are no copay, it's just a deductible and everything is out of pocket. Until you reach the deductible. There are products where it's a percentage copay, and if it's a percentage, that percentage is going to adjust according to whatever is dispensed. Where this is a real problem in terms of attempting to implement is with what we would call flat copay designs, where say it's a $5, $10, or $20 copay. Our systems are simply not set up to do that. We do have programs to do that in Medicare Part D. Those are a separate system, unfortunately, from that were built now whenever Part D was implemented. I think it's about a dozen years ago to allow that. But they are not common in the commercial market, and it would be a very big IT lift. In all respect to Senator Bates, it is not possible to make those kind of adjustments in now about 9 months' time and have them be executed well. It would be a very expensive process and would take a considerable period of time. I think our general view is, since this, the bill that we all worked on going into last February and were able to successfully get through this body collaboratively with a number of interested parties, just having taken effect in January, I think our encouragement would be, let's focus and find out where the actual problem is. If there are payers in the market who are not fully compliant with what we just did last year and was just implemented now 3 months ago, let's have find out who they are and have DCBS do some work to use their tools to get them compliant. And then see where we are. We think this is very premature, given the work that's been done so far and the lack of any use of enforcement mechanisms. At least for our health plans, and I would expect it to be so, we've had no complaints about this because we were doing it before we passed the bill. Again, we do think it's helpful for people to sync up the dispensing dates of multiple medications, and it's why we have long allowed it to be done. Where the copay adjustment is an issue, these are generally fairly modest copays. We have to remember this is in some significant part done for the individual's convenience, and it does not seem a large burden to have that copay be paid. The pharmacy does get a dispensing fee for each dispensing they make.
Okay. What I would recommend you to do is to meet with Dr. Bates and see if there's a meeting of the minds at all, because the bill is going to move, and so I would appreciate it. Maybe you've already met with him, but I would encourage you to do that again.
Thank you.
See if there's any changes. All right. With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 8401, and I want to we have a quorum. Okay, I will open a work session on Senate Bill 121.
Senate Bill 121 authorizes electors in affected territory to propose a plan for abating a health hazard other than annexation of a territory. It requires cost effectiveness as a criteria to consider by the Oregon Health Authority or Environmental Quality Commission before approving or rejecting an alternative plan. It alters the number of residents necessary to petition local boards of health to initiate annexation proceedings. There's a -2 amendment which clarifies that cost analysis for alternative plans to annexation is only appropriate when proposed by the city to respond to the petition. It requires 40% of residents to sign the petition to annex. It clarifies that if the petition is withdrawn before the Oregon Health Authority finds danger to the public health exists, all proceedings will be terminated. It clarifies that if the petition is withdrawn after a danger to public health exists, an alternative plan can be evaluated. It clarifies when annexation of extension is final. There is minimal revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Okay, and who is it that's supposed to talk to
Senator
the day?
Hansel.
What? Who?
Aaron Doyle
will explain the -2s very briefly.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, I think Zena did a fantastic job summarizing. Basically, there were some blanks in the original.
Name
I apologize. Aaron Doyle, on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities, the -2s were me working with the Oregon Health Authority to clarify some issues in the bill, the base bill, and in addition, fill in the blanks of the base bill to include that 40%, which we felt was a reasonable threshold for making sure that we're not just having 11 people affect thousands of people's lives, but not making it so onerous that no one could have their any health hazards that exist abated. We believe this is a good clarification of the law and allows us to do the right thing, but maybe not necessarily force annexation. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you very much. We're in work session.
Madam Chair, I move the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 121.
Senator Cruz moves the -2 amendments into Senate Bill 121. Any discussion? Any opposition?
They are adopted.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 121 as amended by the Dash 2 amendments to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 121 with the Dash 2 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Senator
Shields. Excuse.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Hansel will carry this bill, and I will close the work session on Senate Bill 121. And but Senator Bates isn't here, correct? Okay, you text Senator Bates, and I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 696.
Senate Bill 696 directs the Oregon Health Authority to study the need for and development of recommendations to changes in licensure of healthcare practitioners to treat individuals diagnosed with autism spectrum disorders. There may be a fiscal and revenue impact, but statements have not yet been issued.
And we're going to call Paul Trudeau. Hi, Paul. This is Lori Monis Anderson. Welcome to the hearing. We have just opened a public hearing on 696. And when Senator Bates walks in, would you mind if I let him interrupt your testimony if he happens to come while you're testifying?
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. My name is Paul Trudeau, and I'm a resident of Portland, Oregon. I'm speaking today as a consumer and as someone who has worked with this committee and Senator Bates and others over the last, I think, 5 or 6 years now on these issues. I am very happy now to be in a position of working through, you know, the fine details of implementation on insurance reform and issues for autism treatment rather than the base bill. So again, thank you so much, everyone, for your unanimous approval of Senate Bill 365 2 years ago. I think when Senator Bates comes in, he'll, I think, give you a little bit more details about exactly what we're doing. But let me, I think, just describe some of the kinds of issues that implementation issues that we are having that he's working through. When the bill was passed, it established a management structure for insurer approval and management of treatment for autism, including but not limited to applied behavior analysis, which was something that has developed a lot of support nationally. Recently, the Oregon Health Evidence Review Commission joined the United States Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality in finding a number of different forms of ABA to be effective evidence-based interventions for autism. The Oregon Health Plan is now covering ABA. And what the kinds of issues we're running into really are in terms of licensing and credentialing for the different providers of ABA therapy. ABA, I in my notes in the Exhibit A, I included a letter that several OHSU faculty members gave me a couple of years ago regarding that, and I see. Would you like me to pause now to allow Senator Bates before?
Okay, yeah, Senator Bates.
Okay, let Paul finish.
Okay, well, you're supposed to finish, Paul.
Thank you very much, Senator. In my letter, in Exhibit A, I attached a statement that several OHSU faculty members gave me 2 years ago describing ABA as part of their recommendation to me, for coverage and so forth for my, for my own kids. And the thing that makes it tricky to regulate is that, on the one hand, we have a new practice that has been developing nationwide that is very specific to ABA, and they've done some really great work with my kids and nationwide with many patients with autism and related conditions. And at the same time, it is also something that intersects with existing professions such as psychology, speech-language pathology, occupational therapy, and so forth. My own youngest son's ABA therapy, he had an intensive ABA program for a year or two that was recommended by his physician at OHSU and Kaiser. and was actually managed and administered by a speech-language pathologist licensed in Oregon who did her graduate work 20 years ago at UCLA in applied behavior analysis. There was no ABA-specific credential at the time. She got her license in speech-language pathology and has been practicing ABA ever since and doing really outstanding work. So in creating the Senate Bill 365, we created the structure that tried to bring everybody together. We were licensing the people, the BCBAs who didn't already have any kind of license, and registering the other professionals like psychologists and speech-language pathologists who were doing ABA. And we ran into basically issues of conflicting authority and in terms of just exactly how that would be managed. And so Senate Bill 696, we've been working on with Senator Bates, is designed to address some of those issues of conflicting authority, that people who are licensed and credentialed could continue doing that as long as they were with appropriate direction from their own boards, and we're licensing those previously unlicensed people with the BCBAs who can do that. There are some other technical issues on the second page of my testimony describing just various sort of glitches with the statute. Nothing anywhere in the statute said it actually had anything to do with ABA. And it could be misinterpreted to basically prohibit any provider from doing any service for autism without being dual registered with the board. It has sort of a unique one-off feature that made it administratively difficult for the Oregon Health Licensing Agency to manage, and just a number of other technical issues like that. And so I'm very, very grateful to Senator Bates and his staff for their dedicated work on this issue. They've talked to a whole lot of people, I'm really looking forward to the final language that is coming out. So
thank you.
Unless you have any questions, I'll turn that over to Senator Bates.
Thank you. Please proceed. And we have a number of people to testify, so if everyone can stick to about 3 minutes, I would appreciate it.
Thank you, Chair Anderson and committee members. My name is Alan Bates. I'm a state senator from District 3. I'll get right to it here. This is really about, in the end, taking care of kids who need applied behavior analysis who are on the autistic spectrum. I'm not going to go into all that. You're going to hear more about it from others. Last year, we passed a really landmark bill, Senate Bill 365, that for the first time laid out, we at least tried to lay out exactly with sideboards and protection for children, what we're going to do with this new technique that is so effective for autistic kids. There's no question about its effectiveness now. It is hugely effective, and we wanted to lay out sideboards. What we did was put together a board called the Behavior Analysis Regulatory Board, which I will just refer to as the BARB from here on out, folks. Let's make it simple. So we set this board up, and that board was designed to allow people to be registered and licensed to do a behavior analysis. The error we made, the overreach we had, was it was set up so it was the only one that could do that. The problem is there's five or six other boards that also have that in their scope of practice: physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, and several others. They have within their scope of practice that they have people who are properly trained to do forms of or actual behavior analysis. This board doesn't have and shouldn't have the power to tell those boards what to do. So the BARB now in the Dash 2 amendments, which we at the moment have consensus on, which we'll be going through very carefully tomorrow and necessary Monday and bring back to you next week during a work session as a consensus bill. If it's not, we won't bring it back to you. What we'll bring back to you is something that says the BARB will do this. The people who are not or not licensed by one of the other boards will go through their boards to get their analysis registration done. The BARB will only take care of those who do not fall in those categories. And the people who we're talking about are people who have advanced degrees in various fields, which they've also been included in those fields. They have been trained in ABA, and the BARB will set up the requirements for that, for them to become licensed under the BARB to do behavior analysis. So it's clean. It separates these boards out. They're not at crosswise with each other. And one board isn't telling another board what to do, which ends up in something that really isn't only not appropriate, probably isn't legal. So this separates all that out, makes it much simpler and much more straightforward. I mean to make a point that there's a difference between licensure and certification. You could be certified to get licensed sometimes, but depends on the board you're working with. So that is not a big roadblock to people going through the BARB. The BARB will set those issues up. The other issue you have to think about, and this is the part where it gets a little more complicated sometimes, is you have to be certified by certain insurers in order to get paid and credentialed. And that credentialing is a very long and involved process that's set up by the insurers. There's nothing in this bill that tells insurers they have to credential certain people. They can set their own panels up as long as those panels are adequate. They're responsible for making sure the people involved are fit to do it, have had background checks, all the things we usually normally do for credentialing. So that is what they do, and it's not in this bill. We're not restricting them from doing that, okay? The other change of this is the board is going to be slightly enlarged because it's too small right now to get the work done. It needs to get done. And this time, because of some other issues that have come up, to be confirmed the board, you got to go through the Senate. We didn't do that the first time. It was simply the governor selected the board, and that was it. We think it needs to be wider, and we think it needs more oversight, and that's why we're running through the Senate now for Senate confirmation. So that's basically what this bill does. It cleans up, I think, when I look at it, it cleans up 365, makes it more functional, takes away some of the issues of conflict with the other boards, and gets us on a line where we can really go forward and help these kids. I think it's a great improvement in the bill. I want to thank Julie McFadden, my staffer, for going crazy this week trying to get all this done, and everyone behind me who have worked very hard in the last week and a half, 2 weeks, to come up with consensus, which we think is reflected in the Dash 2s. We just got them an hour or two ago. We're going to go line by line through them tomorrow and early next week, and we'll bring back to you a consensus, actual consensus bill. And if we don't, we won't bring it back to you.
Okay. So what we'll do is we'll put this on the 20th calendar. Hopefully you'll have time.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee.
All right. Thank you very much. There's a Brian Niebert has to – we still have 773 open, and so, Brian – I need to call you up, or has he left already? On 77. Oh, there you are, Brian. Well, I'm not going to 773 yet, so. Okay. All right. All right. With that, they're leaving early too. No. Well, we're still on 696. So where's the? Okay, Lindy Osborne, Alice Austin, and Kai Walker. And again, you're going to hear a buzzer when your 3 minutes are up. Please come forward. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a novice at this. This is my first time, so please have patience with me. My name is Mrs. Lynn D. Osborne. I'm speaking for my husband, Kyle, and myself on behalf of our son, Cameron, who is 23 years old with autism. I sent an email to you guys right before this committee get together here, and I'll give the hard copy over to this gentleman. We have been consumers of applied behavior analysis, ABA, for over 20 years. We have also been advocates of applied behavior analysis for over 20 years. Our son, now 23, was diagnosed at OHSU's Child Development and Rehabilitation Center, CDRC, in August of 1994, with severe autism. In fact, you have in one of your exhibits that Paul was referring to, had an exhibit from Dr. Darren Sikora. She was on our son's diagnostic team. She stated on the report that our son's autism was one of the most severe cases she had ever seen in her career. No one at CDRC ever told us about ABA. We found ABA by pure luck within a few weeks of the diagnosis by reading a book, Let Me Hear Your Voice. We were baffled by the great opposition to ABA here in Oregon. You see, with severe autism, the eclectic program wasn't going to cut it for our son. Our son had the most severe autism Dr. Sikora had seen. With the the science behind it, we proceeded to implement a home ABA program. We had Dr. Tristram Smith from UCLA and the Young Autism Project consult our home program. We have the landmark due process case for our ABA home program for at least 40 hours a week, and we won that due process case in 1996. That case found that a home ABA program was more appropriate than the eclectic program put forth by the State of Oregon, Portland Public Schools, and Multnomah ESD. In fact, their testimony was that ABA was bad. It was terrible. Over the years, with Oregon entrenched in the eclectic program of services for autism, we had to use board-certified behavior analysts from the East Coast for the last 20 years. So it's so ironic that most of the people wanting to hijack the Behavior Analysis Regulatory Board, BARB, are the very same ones that have badmouthed ABA all these years. This is such a bad bill in so many ways. There is no emergency. There is no other state in the country that allows this.
Oh, your time is up.
Okay.
Can you sum up, Rin, in just a few
seconds? We can't believe that the insurance industry would allow this, as it could open them up to all kinds of insurance fraud. We implore, without the conditions that would be addressed in the amendment, we implore you to oppose 696. Thank you.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Alice Austin. I am a doctoral level board certified behavior analyst in the Portland area. I have a private practice. I am also a member of the Behavior Analysis Regulatory Board, and I am an adjunct professor of behavior analysis at Oregon Institute of Technology in Wilsonville. However, today I am representing the Oregon Association for Behavior Analysis.
I'm trying to fix this. I'm sorry.
The joys of technology.
It's a healthcare dance party.
Well, behind please proceed. Way. It's not going to take away the time. All right.
First, we'd like to thank you, the committee, Chair Mona Anderson, for allowing us to testify today, and for your work over the years to make evidence-based treatments, including ABA, available to Oregon's families. Today, we are really here to support the Senate Bill 696 based on the recommendations by a variety of providers coming to a consensus. We strongly support allowing other healthcare providers to practice under their own boards, including people like speech pathologists or psychologists, and addressing some of the issues that we've had with the Behavior Analysis Regulatory Board. So specifically, we would like to see that the BARB will regulate the titles of licensed behavior analyst, licensed assistant behavior analyst, and then allow the other licensed healthcare providers, again, to practice under their own boards. We also advocate that the speech-language pathologist that currently sits on the BARB be replaced with a licensed assistant behavior analyst. That's at the undergraduate level. And that the current public member of the BARB be replaced with a consumer of ABA services, so we get a better representation of consumers. And we also agree that there should be a separate registry for interventionists, similar to the structure of DHS or like the child care registry, so including things like fingerprints and ensuring that we've done a criminal background check on these guys. So we ask that Senator Bates and other stakeholders that you continue to work with the Oregon Association for Behavior Analysis and the other providers to arrive at solutions and language specific to the issues related to consumer access and protection. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Chi Walker, Tom Holt, Tracy Jane Ralston. Okay, Wendy Marhol-Lysik can come up too. Okay, go please ahead. Proceed.
Good afternoon. My name is Tracy Jane Ralston, and I live in Eugene, Oregon. And I am a doctoral student at the University of Oregon and also an academic associate for Arizona State University online applied behavior analysis program. Thank you for having me, Madam Chair, and members of the committee, and for hearing my testimony today. I'm here to testify that I'm in support of this bill and the changes in the language as proposed by ORABA, Oregon Association of Behavior Analysis. Before becoming a BCBA, a board-certified behavior analyst, I worked as a special education teacher, and in that role, I used applied behavior analysis techniques, and I worked with many speech-language pathologists, occupational therapists, and other related service providers. And I understand that you can use ABA without providing ABA therapy. So I think there's a distinction there. And that's why I strongly agree that other licensed healthcare providers, such as speech language pathologists, should be regulated by their own boards, and they should bill insurance under their own license.
Thank you so much.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Wendy Mihalicek. I am a doctoral level board certified behavior analyst and a faculty member at the University of Oregon in special education. I'm also a member of the BARB, but here today my primary emphasis is to speak as a member of the higher education community. I live in Springfield. I'm in support of Senate Bill 696, and in particular the proposed changes to language by ORABA. In particular, I want to make the distinction that applied behavior analysis is a well-established discipline with mature bodies of empirical literature guiding our selection of assessment and intervention strategies for this particular population and others. We have established standards for what constitutes an evidence-based practice and, importantly, clearly delineated service delivery methods and internationally recognized experience and education requirements for practice. The work of a behavior analyst differs in a few unique ways from that of other healthcare professionals. Board certified behavior analysts, in particular, one of my primary concerns, the BCBAs are uniquely prepared to develop programming for children on the autism spectrum who have heterogeneity in terms of their support needs, and practitioners who go through certification programs, other licensed healthcare professionals who go through other certification programs may not have the expertise to individualize programs as are going to be needed for children across the spectrum. To ignore this distinction is really at the peril of positive outcomes for a wide range of children with autism spectrum disorder. However, I'm in agreement with the shortage issue in Oregon can be partially addressed by allowing other licensed healthcare providers to have their practice of ABA regulated by their own boards and not the BARB. It's important to note that we do have 40 BCBAs, 6 associate level behavior analysts, and 5 doctoral level behavior analysts residing in Oregon. There is clearly a shortage. But this number is expected to increase as we have higher education programs providing approved accreditation in behavior analysis. So we actually have programs at the Oregon Institute of Technology, the University of Oregon, and Southern Oregon University either graduating behavior analyst at the master's or bachelor's level or soon to be graduating. I'm happy to take any questions that you have.
Let's have Tom and then.
Sure. Chair Moss Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, and Tom Holt with Cambia Health Solutions, here in support, at least conceptually, of the amendments that have just come out in the last hour or so. We haven't had a chance to read them, but we have had good conversations over the last week or so with the autism advocates and others who were involved in the development of Senate Bill 365 and Senator Bates. There were some administrative issues related to the board, as well as this issue of sort of double licensing that needed some clarification. I just want to expand on one small point that's important about the licensure. In the original bill, we had had the other licensed providers, psychologists, for example, going through this new board as a means of quality control to make sure that we didn't have every psychologist saying, oh, I'm now an expert on applied behavior analysis, and that they actually, you know, were testing by having this certification, they do that. By removing them from this board, there's going to be more heavy reliance on carriers in our credentialing processes, and we will have to make some adjustments to our credentialing processes to focus on making sure that people do have the training and background to provide the ABA services. I think the issue of whether or not there's coverage for ABA services was settled in the 2013 session and the two-year conversation leading up to Senate Bill 365, and we're pleased to be able to provide that support to our members who need those services, but just want the committee to be aware that we will, as carriers, kind of fill the gap that's going to be potentially created in terms of the quality control on the providers, so that we know that the providers working with mostly children have all the appropriate background and training.
Great. Questions? Thank you very much. Toby Rates and Marion Blankenship.
Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. My name is Toby Rates, and I am here in my capacity as the Executive Director of the Autism Society of Oregon, as well as the mother of two children on the autism spectrum who receive autism therapies, including applied behavior analysis. The Autism Society is the largest autism group in Oregon and the only one that operates statewide. I wanted to point out that there are over 9,000 children in Oregon who are identified as having an autism spectrum disorder, and their families access ASO as a resource throughout Oregon. First, I did want to express our appreciation to Dr. Bates for his longstanding support of the autism community, and to express our support for the work in progress that is Senate Bill 696. We're looking forward to reviewing that version that just came out line by line tomorrow. But we want to make sure that the critical elements of the joint statement that was sent to Dr. Bates by members of the Oregon ABA Association as well as advocates are included in there. That includes licensing and regulation of the board certified behavior analysts and the board certified assistant behavior analysts by the BARB, the Behavior Analysis Regulatory Board, with licensing and regulation of other licensed healthcare providers by their respective boards under the auspices of their own professional certifications and licensing and within the scope of their training and competence to provide ABA services. We agree with the changes to the setup of the BARB, including replacing the speech pathologist with a licensed BCABA, that's the assistant level, and replacing the public member with a consumer of ABA services. We're also in favor of setting up a registry for the line therapists, who are called interventionists, that's housed within the OHA's health licensing office, with interventionists who meet specific criteria that will protect the safety of the vulnerable population that they serve and provide for direct training and supervision by licensed ABA providers. Until recently, and I can speak to this personally, when we hired interventionists to care for my son, who was nonverbal, there was nothing that the state provided to make sure that these people were safe for my child. We didn't even know enough to do a background check, so I'm really happy to see these things implemented. But having said that, our experience with line therapists we've worked with over the years has been very good, and we remain in contact with them. We have had our children in many different autism therapies, including ABA, occupational therapy, speech-language therapy, and all of these techniques have used ABA techniques to help our sons achieve important and measurable goals.
Thank you very much.
To be supported. Thank you.
Marion.
Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Marion Blankenship. I will be very brief. But I'd be happy for the dance party, too. just here to signal our support for the Dash 2 amendment pending our review of it tomorrow. And I just want to remind the committee that Pacific Source has been pretty actively engaged around this issue for several years. Definitely our thanks go out to Senator Bates and the many folks that we have worked with on behalf of this particular issue. It has been quite a journey. So I'm hopeful that that we will manage to sort of see this next step through. I think that I would agree with Tom Holt's characterization of it. You know, for the most part, really some technical cleanup needed here and some administrative simplification. I do want to underscore again just the importance of sort of recognizing that insurers will need to and will continue to. To credential providers, licensed providers who are seeking to do ABA services, and I think that's important because we certainly want quality services for our kiddos. So with that, great. I'll close.
Question. Thank you very much. We will be scheduling a work session if everyone is in agreement. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 696 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 880. Zena. Well, let's continue with 773, and let's call up there were other people.
It's just Kevin George here from
DHS. Yes, it was Jason. I don't see the note. I know you had it. Yeah. Josh and Ashlyn. Okay,
come on up.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, please. Josh. Okay. Great. Please proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ashlyn Strong, and I represent HealthShare of Oregon, a coordinated care organization serving approximately 240,000 Oregon Health Plan members in Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington counties. With regard to Senate Bill 773, it is our understanding that the policy contemplated by this bill is already consistent with existing law that you can find under Oregon Administrative Rule 410-141-3050, the title of which is CCO Enrollment for Children Receiving Health Services. For that reason, we are neutral on this bill, and we're happy to continue our work with the Oregon Health Authority to ensure that all children have continuous coverage under the Oregon Health Plan. There is one minor language change that we believe would be necessary if this bill were to pass. It's a subtle but important nuance. Under Section 2, Subsection 3, it says something about CCOs shall enroll members into CCOs. But CCOs are not permitted under, I think, federal law to enroll members into ourselves. So the Oregon Health Authority is the one that enrolls members into a coordinated care organization. And I'd be happy to take any questions.
Josh?
Yeah. Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, Josh Ballack, representing the Coalition for Healthy Oregon. So, as I understand it, the CCOs, as Ashlyn just said, cannot enroll anyone that we actually have to get assigned through the OHA via the MMIS system. So Section 2.3 is actually doesn't actually jive with how things actually work. Senator Gelster, when she testified, said that that the issue that was coming up was where there was a kid moving from one community into another and not getting coverage. And it is our understanding, and I'm going to use an example, that if a kid were to move from Coos Bay to, say, Bend, that Coos Bay CCO would still be covering that life until the kid was re-enrolled into that Bend CCO. And if a provider was to give services to that child and build the BEN-CCO, that there would be a process called reconciliation, where one CCO would actually pay up and then there would be a balance. And this type of stuff happens pretty routinely. If there are cases that of where kids aren't getting covered, please let us know. We are happy to make sure that the kids are, and anyone that we serve in the Oregon Health Plan are actually getting the coverage and making sure that that's taken care of. But please know that we're committed to making sure that happens. But we do believe there are safeguards and that we are making sure that that is. But, you know, I want to make sure that nobody falls through the cracks.
Great. Brian.
Chairman Anderson, members of the committee, Brian Niebert, Legislative Coordinator for Healthcare Programs in the Oregon Health Authority. I'd love to limit my testimony to ditto, but I don't think I can. I'd like to echo the what Ashlyn regarded referred to as that CCOs don't actually enroll members, and actually through federal law they are not allowed to enroll members. They're enrolled through the Oregon Health Authority and medical assistance programs and assigned to coordinated care organizations. So that would be a language clarification that I think is would be necessary. And I think that we have procedures to address this, but would be happy to continue the discussion. But I think the section 2 sub 3 is something that would need to be amended to make clear what is the actual process.
Okay, and Kevin George wanted to talk
really
too, but yes,
question.
Please.
So just to clarify what you all have said, and in particular, Ms. Strong, you started us out with this, you think that this is, and Mr. Balick, you seem to confirm this, you don't think this is actually necessary statute because you think it's already being taken care of. So unfortunately, Senator Gelser isn't here anymore, and we can certainly ask her, but what's going on that you think that she thinks this bill is necessary?
Ladies first.
Well,
I mean, I
well,
just,
she
we
put on,
don't know. We
yeah, she put on the record that she had an experience with someone that one wasn't able to get the inhaler and another one wasn't able
oh,
to
yeah,
get
I
medication.
I thought those were generic examples. I apologize for not hearing that those were specific.
But I would appreciate
examples.
It if you would maybe follow up to see. I'm still going to schedule this for a work session, but we may not need the bill after she and you talk. Is that all right?
Chairman Anderson, absolutely committed to make sure that that happens and
okay.
that this bill doesn't need to move forward and that we get this resolved.
Okay. Any other questions? And then I think Kevin George from DHS, do you need to say anything? No. Okay. All right. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 773, and let's schedule it, you know, but we may be removing it once we talk with Senator Gelser. And with that, the final bill, I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 880.
Sina. Senate Bill 880 exempts businesses that provide only palliative care or operate rural health clinics from the requirement that licensed physicians hold the majority of voting stock in a professional corporation organized for the purpose of practicing medicine or be a majority of directors of professional corporation. There is no amendment, and fiscal and revenue statements have not been issued.
Okay. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. For the record, my name is Oliver Alexander, and we're here in support of Senate Bill 880. For the past 3 years, my business partner and I have been researching healthcare and specifically the many problems that plague the healthcare access of rural areas. And through our exhaustive research, we formed our company, Orchid Health, which opened its first family practice certified rural health clinic in Oak Ridge, Oregon last summer. We knew going into Oak Ridge that the area had 80% of its primary care demand going unmet, and patients were left to travel 45 minutes to Eugene and Springfield to receive care. And this demand was certainly realized when we opened our doors and saw 300 new patients in our first month of operations, and we today manage over 850 patients' care, most of which are Medicaid patients. Additionally, we've integrated mental health services for children and adults at our practice, and that is for Medicaid patients, and we plan to continue to grow our mental health services to provide therapy in schools, both the elementary and high school in Oak Ridge. And we additionally plan on opening Oak Ridge's first and only dental practice that provides care for Medicaid patients. However, it's not very common to see entrepreneurs like us enter the healthcare services field, especially in the rural areas. And that's because of legislation such as ORS 58.375. Our amendment proposes to allow certified rural health clinics and palliative care organizations to be exempt from the requirement that physicians own a majority of the stock and carry out the clinic's direction. And to address potential concerns you may have, we've included two specific provisions in our amendment. And the first is that we propose only certified rural health clinics be exempt, and this is because the state of Oregon, through DMAP, has over 60 pages of OARs that we are required to follow as a certified rural health clinic, which ensures that the quality of care that we're delivering is the highest standard. And additionally, we've included wording, as eight states have already done, that states that businesses must have wording in their bylaws that forbids companies to direct or control medical judgment. And this is to ensure that patient care is carried out at the best example from our medical providers who are governed by their respective licensing boards.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Orion Falvey, and I'm Oliver's co-founder of Orchid Health. So the mission behind this bill is simple. It's to provide healthcare access to 130,000 people in rural communities like Oak Ridge who don't have access to a clinic or a primary care provider. Oak Ridge is a town where about 10 years ago, there were three clinics, excuse me, and two clinics closed down because the providers got burnt out. Additionally, Lane County looked into opening up a clinic in Oak Ridge and deemed it not feasible or sustainable. So these 130,000 people in rural communities don't have access to care, and we like passionate and energetic and business-minded individuals to be able to serve these communities. When people don't have access to primary care, it means that our kids can often struggle in school if they're not healthy. It means they end up in the court systems, unnecessary ER visits, and hospitalizations, which cost the whole state money. So in order to really understand what it took for Oliver and I to open up these clinics and why there aren't clinics serving these 130,000 people, it's because to open these clinics, we had to go through, raise the funding to open the clinic. We had to recruit providers from other states. We had to contract and negotiate with the insurance companies. And so if you look at existing rural clinics, they don't have the time or resources to do this when the physician owns the clinic and also has to try to recruit new providers, which is why over 50% of rural clinics are constantly trying to recruit new providers but having trouble. So we just want to add to the existing rural clinics out there that are owned by physicians in order to meet this unmet need and allow people who are driven and business-minded to work with the medical community to open up clinics in these communities.
Yes, Senator Steiner.
First of all, I'm generally very supportive. Second of all, yay you guys for being entrepreneurs in this way. And third, I'm curious, have you had any connection with the various loan repayment programs or loan forgiveness programs that are available in the state to help you in recruiting?
Madam Chair and Senator Hayward, yes, we have. We've taken advantage of all the resources,
great,
wonderful resources that the state offer. And as we've looked around at other rural communities, we see clinics not taking advantage of these resources because, again, they're overworked and they're just trying to stay afloat.
Quick follow-up, Madam Chair. And as a physician, I always get a little wary about non-physicians telling me how to practice medicine, but I think your point is well taken about the fact that doctors, we don't get a lot of business training in medical school, and we're busy taking care of patients and don't really feel like being business people at the same time. So people like you doing something like this makes a lot of sense. I guess the question I have is, how do you talk with the clinicians that you hire about who's going to make the medical decisions, and how does that end up in writing, and what do you do to reassure them and the state that they're going to be making the healthcare decisions and not you guys?
The medical decisions our staff make are based on their experience, their knowledge, and the authority granted to them by the Oregon various boards. However, we do employ a medical director as well, who works with our care teams to outline care protocols, edit our policies and procedures, and work with them to deliver the highest quality of care possible.
And to add to that, this law is actually in place to support an outdated or a payment model that we're moving away from, a fee-for-service model, which incentivized clinics to see high-volume patients and have care decrease. But now we're shifting to a value-based system, and so our incentives as business people are actually aligned with health outcomes for patients because we've negotiated contracts with insurance payers to pay us based on the quality of care we're providing, not based on the volume of patients that we see. So our interests are quality outcomes. And that's because we've spent the time and energy to try to change the payment system and negotiate these contracts.
Thank you very much.
Great. That's cool. So in your clinic in Oak Ridge, how many nurses do you have? How many physicians? You have a medical director.
We have one full-time family nurse practitioner. We have a full-time registered nurse. We have a part-time physician. And we have a medical director who commits about 10 hours per month. And we additionally have medical assistants, two qualified mental health professionals, and they provide therapy services to children and adults, and then a couple of front office members as well.
Great. ONA came to me and said that they would like to have an amendment dealing with the relationship between nurse practitioners and physicians, and I'm not sure if they're going to come up. Jen is okay to come in and talk. So it may be that you will need to talk to her to make sure that everyone's on board with the amendments that she's proposing.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, Jen Baker testifying on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association. We are in the process of working to have an amendment drafted that would allow nurse practitioners to be equal share owners or majority share owners of professional corporations to practice medicine. So it is it fits nicely within this relating to clause, but is not directly related to the full content of the bill. But hoping that this could be a nice way to remedy a problem in statute that does not allow nurse practitioners to equally own professional corporation to practice medicine or have the majority share of that professional corporation.
And would you be?
We support this. Anything to increase access. Again, I think it would work nicely together.
Okay. Any other questions? No. Brian Behringer and Elizabeth Remley.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Brian Behringer with the Oregon Medical Association. You have our written testimony, but I'll just put a couple things on the record. We have some concerns with Senate Bill 880 as written. We've also, so two separate issues. We've also had some conversations with the ONA about the NP piece, and I think that's a piece that can actually get worked out. But it's a little bit of a different issue than what is in the underlying bill, as was mentioned. And I know that there's other folks here, and that may be something that needs to be worked out outside of the corporate practice of medicine under maybe corporation statutes to maybe solve some other issues that would come up with that. But with regards to 880, the corporate practice of medicine was originally, the doctrine was created to prevent conflicts from business interests overruling medical judgment. And we think that that's still a valid doctrine for physicians, for NPs, for other folks. And so that's something we would want to preserve. Within 880, it carves out another exception. And there are already a couple of exceptions currently carved out. And I just wanted to point to them because we have not had a chance to talk to the proponents. And I think, frankly, that's what we need to do is talk to them and see if one of these existing exceptions or something therein could work. But there is currently Oregon allows for corporate control of an organization as long as a corporation is a nonprofit under Oregon law that was organized for the purposes of either being a federal health center or a federally qualified health center. So there are some things there, I think, with some safeguards built around them that would work. And I think that's where we'd like to explore with the proponents. So we have concerns. Again, it has to go back with the reason for the doctrine to make sure that we're not overruling or having conflicts of interest between the business and the healthcare sense. But we'd like to talk to the proponents. And again, I think the other issue is something that can be solved as well. So.
Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, Elizabeth Remley here today on behalf of the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants. We echo what both Jen Baker for the Nurses Association said, as well as the desire to respect the current statute as outlined by the OMA. I think that this bill sort of exposed some issues for nurse practitioners and physician assistants around owning clinics, and we'd like to figure that out. We don't have an opinion necessarily about what the proponents are trying to do. I will mention briefly that one of OSPA's most active members is Edwin Way, who owns the clinic in Oak Ridge that is not Orchid Health, and he for a long time has been the only primary care provider in that community. And when Orchid opened, he actually expressed his support, and he was really excited that he was getting some help serving that community. So he's been very supportive of Orchid Health, and we'd like to work with them to figure this out for them. So thank you.
Yeah, I like a model where it's increasing access, because here they are in an area where physicians don't want to go.
Yeah.
And so we need to change the model so that entrepreneurs like them can work the system. And it's the same with dental. Dental, you can't own a, you know, dental is more draconian than it is for physicians. So I would definitely love to move this bill. I would like you to talk with the OMA, and I will schedule it for a work session the 21st to see if there become a meeting of the minds.
The
20th. Yeah, the 20th.
You can schedule me. I
could.
First.
All right?
You can schedule.
Yeah, Senator Steiner here.
I just was going to say what she said, so.
Yeah.
We're all good.
All right. Thank you, everyone. I think that's it, correct? I don't need to do anything. Then I word. Do anything. Then I word. I think that's it, correct? I don't need to.